You're listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
Good evening. Death may be the only real certainty in life, but the manner of it has changed remarkably over just a few generations, and the moral dilemmas it poses haunt us as never before. Where once we died young and suddenly, of infection, violence or overwork, we now mostly live on to a lingering death with the degenerative diseases of old age. The question of whether the law should allow us to choose to die before nature has run its course becomes ever more pressing. A third of the babies born today can expect to live to 100. It's in the news again this week. The new chairwoman of the pressure group Dignity and Dying has claimed that thousands of doctors have been risking jail by illegally helping their terminally ill patients to die. Her figures and how she came to them are disputed. The BMA will be debating the issue again at their annual meeting next week. It's been firmly opposed to its members helping people to die, and surveys suggest most doctors still don't like the idea. The general public's attitude is the exact opposite. Around 4 out of 5, when polled, say they think it should be allowed. Elsewhere, it's already legal, with varying sets of conditions. In 5 American states, California became the latest this week, and several European countries. The arguments on both sides are powerful, emotive, and often evidenced by heartrending individual cases. The traditional idea of the sanctity of life set against the perceived compassion and mercy of ending suffering. The case for personal autonomy runs up against fears that the vulnerable, old, confused, disabled, might be pressured into death for personal gain or institutional efficiency. In the quarter of a century the moral maze has been on the air, this is the subject that has vexed us most often. We've brought back witnesses tonight who've argued their case with us before to see where that argument stands now and where it might lead. Death on Demand. Our moral maze tonight. Our panel, Anne McElvoy, senior editor on The Economist, Claire Fox from the Institute of Ideas, the Anglican priest and polemicist Giles Fraser, and new to the panel, if not the programme, Mona Siddiqui, professor of Islamic and interreligious studies at Edinburgh University. Mona, can you envisage yourself ever wanting to be helped to die? And would it be your religion that would determine whether you would or not?
I've often talked to my siblings about this. And it's paradoxically the one thing we talk about quite a lot, and at the same time, none of us ever want to face.
Giles Fraser?
Well, my mum's made me promise that if she ever gets too far for her, I'll take her to Dignitas. And I've said yes because it's my mum, but I'm dead against. I want a society in which the expectation is that we all look after each other, and I think making death a matter of choice undermines the social fabric of our mutual commitments. But I've got to say yes to my mum.
Claire Fox.
I think we can all project our fears onto the future in a slightly paranoid way. There's anxieties around everything from dementia to the kind of pain one might suffer when somebody like me, a smoker, inevitably ends up with lung cancer. You're like, oh, I won't be able to cope. But I think, whatever about oneself, I think every time anyone expresses that kind of negativity about life, it's up to us as a society to rail against it and to say that life is always worth fighting for and living.
Anne McElvoy.
Well, I've become more convinced of the case for assisted dying over the years and listening to the debates on the moral maze and elsewhere, because it is a right that I would want for myself, and therefore I find it quite difficult to say it's something that I would deny to others. I draw the line, as it happens, at voluntary euthanasia, and that seems to me to be a sensible compromise in what is very difficult but very necessary moral territory to explore tonight.
Panel, thanks very much indeed. Our first witness is Dr. Kevin Ewell, who's a lecturer at Sunderland University, author of Assisted Suicide, The Liberal Humanist Case Against Legislation, who was on the moral maze in 2010, where he argued that, from a secular standpoint, that assisting suicide was worse than suicide itself. Do you feel, in parts of Europe at least, that the argument has shifted from whether to legalise to who should qualify?
I think it has. I think there's been I don't like the term slippery slope, mm-hmm. because I think it implies that some people are right to kill and other people aren't. That's the danger. But I very much, having attended a conference in Amsterdam on euthanasia, I was shocked by how many categories are now sort of included. The most recent one, which is in the news, is a man who is unhappy with his sexuality.
This is a gay man in Belgium, I think,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, correct.
It's a case that another way in which that the issue has peaked over recent days. Anne McElvoy.
Dr. Ewell, we met in 2010, as it happens, on this subject. Nice to see you again. when you say you don't like the slippery slope, but yet there's so much of the argument is all about what would be acceptable, what might we include as a humane and responsible society in assisted dying, what wouldn't we? Is your case that actually pretty much is better to avoid the whole notion, or are there sort of points where you think there and there I would accept it?
I think on an individual case, then that is something that, we can consider. I think there are certain circumstances where it is absolutely right to take action to speed up the death of somebody. Where I draw the line is in changing the law. I think it's wrong to change the law.
Why is it wrong to change the law if there are circumstances in which it would be morally right?
Simply because then if there are very individual circumstances, so a doctor might take action, for instance, in the last hours or days or perhaps even weeks. And I think in some cases we can excuse that, but I think it's dangerous to set it as a precedent and to say that it is legal to do this sort of thing, whereas it's, I think, a doctor taking that decision on an individual basis takes full responsibility for the action, and they're going to be very, very certain that it's the right action to take.
But let's come back to the primary decision maker, usually the person themselves. Would you consider yourself a liberal to the extent that you think that people should broadly make decisions? And this is the most important decision that we're going to make towards the end of our lives, is how we leave it. What's wrong with us as individuals having the power to shape that decision?
Well, we already do have the power to shape that decision. Suicide is legal, according to the 1961 Suicide Act.
But as you well know, in the hard cases that we're addressing here, many people are unable to commit suicide, even assuming that that is an elegant way to go about this. And what we're talking about is making assisted dying an easier transition from life to death, and telling people to go off and commit suicide is not really in the same category.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I would go and tell somebody to commit suicide, but I think it's always an option. It's always a potential for just about everybody. Everybody has the power, and rightly so, to refuse medical treatment. Everybody has the power to refuse food and drink, and they should have that right, and they do have that right.
But why is that? What I'd like to get to just quickly is, why is that the morally preferable route? Either is difficult, I grant you, but why is that morally preferable to just saying, well, actually, when people are terminally ill and have made their wishes clear, that we offer them doctor-assisted dying? What's morally preferable about asking them to
suicide? I think the morally preferable aspect of the whole thing is that we should not, as a society, be participating in the killing of human beings. I think that's a sort of basic value that I would want to try and keep. And if you have an assisted suicide law, that means effectively the state is executing people who are agreeing to be executed, but they are executing people. I can't see in some ways the difference between that and, for instance, capital punishment, which I am opposed to, where people agree. What is the difference between the two scenarios?
Mona Sadiq.
Kevin, do you think it's immoral to help someone you love end their life?
It really depends on the individual circumstance. I don't think, and I would never say for every individual circumstance, no.
So that means in some cases, would you help someone end their life?
I don't know. I will cross that bridge when I come to it, I suppose. But I would like to think that in certain circumstances that I probably would.
So that means you're open to assisted dying?
And not to a change in the law, but to individual circumstances. I can't, you know, in certain circumstances, yes.
So your concern is actually the legalisation of this rather
exactly.
than the principle of assisted dying. But isn't that looking at it slightly back to front? Isn't the real issue, the moral issue here, assisted dying? And going back to the points you were making earlier, doctors are already helping people end their life and coming forward and saying they've done it and they're not being prosecuted. So if it was legalised, if that's your concern, wouldn't it actually offer protection to both the patient and the doctor?
First of all, I don't think it's going to make a big difference to doctors. There's no doctors languishing in prison as we speak because they have taken humane actions. And I think it's an important protection also against people. For instance, there's a case, and I can't remember the name of the woman, who is in prison for smothering her son with a pillow. Of breaking into a hospital. Now, she, of course, claimed that was a mercy killing. And it was taken to court. And of course, it was debated. There's another case very similar where a mother killed her daughter and she was let off. I think courts are the right places to decide cases like that. A change in the law will simply complicate that matter.
But a change in the law wouldn't necessarily mean that doctors and everybody else who are in that position will rush to assist somebody end their life. People take these decisions very seriously. You're making it sound as if a change to the law would mean that people think, oh, that frees us to do this. This is probably the hardest decision anybody would ever make.
Yes, but it's one that doctors will take.
But they're already doing that.
They are already doing that. And I was very impressed when I went to the Netherlands of how far the discussion has gone on, where there are debates there about whether to euthanize the people with dementia. And there was also a big debate about whether the mentally ill should be allowed to have an assisted suicide.
Dr. Yule, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Our next witness is Dr. Michael Irwin, who was a GP and then medical director of the United Nations in New York before he retired. He actually came on The Moral Maze 20 years ago to discuss youth. You were a young man then, Dr. Irwin.
I still am.
Of course you are. To discuss euthanasia, where you said it would be legalised soon. That was 20 years ago. It hasn't. What went wrong from your point of view?
We still have the same opponents today as we had then, mainly religious groups, also the medical establishment, and to a certain extent, disability groups. But I believe passionately in this possibility of doctor-assisted suicide. I've accompanied 5 people to Switzerland in the last 10 years. I've seen how it can be a very dignified and professional procedure. And I always say, one should personalize this. Would you like the option for yourself if you were terminally ill or suffered unbearably?
A one-man religious body here, Giles Fraser.
Not so much, really. I mean, would you be prepared to help anybody who asks for it?
No. As a doctor, I would like to evaluate that person's particular medical problems. Someone should have some kind of medical problems that would justify their being helped to die.
So they have to be dying already?
No. I mean, for example, I'm 85. I have various disabilities from a car accident and others. They're getting gradually worse. In a sense, I'm on borrowed time.
You look pretty fit to me, sir. By date.
But I would like to think that maybe in a few years' time, when I've kind of completed what I want to do in this life, to have the option of going to Switzerland.
So it's not. So for you, you'd be happy for doctors to assist, even if someone's not dying, even if they're not even in any particular pain?
No, they should be suffering unbearably from some medical problem and be mentally competent.
And depression, would that count as one?
That's a difficult question. To me, depression is in that group of kind of a neurosis. If one had a psychosis like schizophrenia, then perhaps one should be able to help that kind of person.
But emotional pain? So, I mean, not just...
No, I think at this stage I would not support that possibility.
But that's still pain. I mean, I'm trying to work out why you think in the case of emotional pain, then you wouldn't be supporting it, but in the case of, you know, if you've physical, literal pain, you would. Why is literal pain so much worse than emotional pain?
Well, emotional pain is very hard to evaluate. If someone has physical disabilities or has something like motor neuron disease and so on, then that can be easily evaluated.
So it's just the testability of this pain that gives you the qualms?
Well, I wouldn't use the word pain. I'd say unbearable suffering is the criteria, and being mentally competent due to medical conditions.
And this would be the same for the young, if they were sort of an 18, 19-year-old who was in pain but not dying?
Yes, any adult, anyone over 18.
You see, I've been in positions in my life where I've been really very unhappy and have thought about taking my own life. And I'm jolly glad I didn't, and I'm jolly glad I never asked anybody to help me to do it, had I, you know, I was able to do it and so forth. And I can just imagine that there are situations where, you know, people will be asking for things that actually they would have later on regretted. Obviously, that's ridiculous because they're dead. They can't do that. But that's something I worry about, what they're asking for, whether it's really true.
Well, no doctor would help someone in that condition, and doctors must be involved in the process.
Why would no doctor help someone there?
Because that is something that can be treatable, what you described about yourself.
So it's untreatable pain, only untreatable pain.
Untreatable, in causing great suffering.
Unbearable suffering.
Unbearable suffering.
Claire Fox.
I'm still struggling, I suppose, because the 39-year-old gay man in Belgium, who hasn't got a medical condition, nonetheless described, and I'm quoting here, that he was had unbearable psychological suffering. And once you have said that that should be sufficient, why would you deny him that right to end his life on your basis, morally?
Well, I wouldn't.
Right, so you would give him assisted suicide?
No, I would see that he had the right treatment.
Right, so the treatment in that instance, if he wants to take his own life or be assisted in taking his own life, you would say yes to? Or you would consider saying yes to?
No, I would not.
No. I'm
That's a psychological condition.
Yes, but I'm struggling
very hard
as to why.
Evaluate.
Yes, but I'm struggling. I tell you why I'm struggling, right? Because the truth of the matter is that now this is apparently this humane thing where we give people choice, right? And this seems to be entirely to giving doctors a lot more power, and it's not that humane at all, because people who are suffering, you decide medically, your suffering doesn't count in my book. That's what you've now just said.
Well, another condition would be there wouldn't just be one doctor involved. There should be at least two doctors involved in any evaluation of something.
That doesn't entirely reassure me. I mean, I'm just asking you morally. So actually, then on the doctor's question, it is interesting because I have to say it's true that a lot more people now disagree with me on this question. But doctors, you know, not for religious reasons, still are opposed, lots of them, to this law, change of the law. Why is that?
I think at least 50% of doctors in this country are in favour of changing the law. And certainly in countries like the Netherlands, you have something like maybe 85% of doctors in favour of the Dutch law, and a similar figure from
Belgium.
But you know
that even though the vast majority of people in the public support changing the law, doctors are much more ambivalent, and they have been in this country for a while, not just the bureaucrats, but as you say, 50-50. Why are doctors squeamish? Can you imagine why they might be?
To me, a doctor's main function, a compassionate doctor, does what is best for his or her patient. And that can help them to die if they are suffering unbearably.
And they know, those doctors who were opposed to this, that actually this is not a medical intervention. It's a great abuse of power, actually.
No, it's a medical intervention.
Dr. Irwin, thank you very much indeed. Our next witness is Professor David Cook, who's a Christian theologian who specialises in medical ethics. When he was teaching at Oxford, he was a regular panellist on this programme in the 90s. When we looked at this issue from different angles, twice while he was on the panel. He's on the line now from Chicago. David, what's changed, do you think? Your view on this or the argument itself?
I think what's changed is Dr. Harold Shipman, who managed to help a number of patients on their way for his own personal gain. I think what's changed is that Parliament has voted consistently not to change the law. And this is not because of some religious ground. It's because there is a belief in the sanctity of human life and the importance of doctors actually really caring for people.
Mona Siddiqui.
Professor Cook, you're a Christian. Is your principal religious objection to assisted dying sanctity of life?
No, I think that sanctity of life is a crucial argument, but I also am concerned about the pragmatic argument, and I'm surprised about two things. First of all, I'm surprised at the definition, because people have been talking about assisted dying. What we're really talking about is assisted killing. What we're actually talking either about an individual taking the drugs themselves or being given the drugs by someone else, as happens in Switzerland. So what we're really talking about is killing people, and I think that goes against human nature. Everywhere, every culture has some rules against taking human life.
But isn't that the problem, that when you use words like killing, that actually stifles the debate? And we don't use that word anymore, or when abortion has been legalised, we've stopped using that word. So we're not saying we're killing.
This is unbelievable. We've been in a setting where there are certain words we take off the table because this will stifle the debate. We're having a perfectly happy debate about whether or not ending someone's life is killing them.
But as a principle, whether it is... As a principle, you talk about sanctity of life, but sanctity of life can mean so many different things to people at different stages of their life. So what is it?
And I'm talking about the slippery slope, not just the principle. I'm talking about the basic pragmatic problems that face doctors, that face patients, that face families if confronted with this kind of choice.
But isn't sanctity of life really a belief? Not everybody believes that all human life is sacred at every stage of their lives.
I think every society has some rules about when it's improper to kill people. And that's a very fundamental human social trait. And it's nothing to do with religion, though religion upholds sanctity of life. But you don't have to be religious to believe that human life is special, okay, different, and ought to be preserved.
Often closely associated with sanctity of life is human dignity. So what gives human life human dignity? Doesn't it actually defy evaluation?
Not at all. I think I've taken part in many programmes where individuals have said, I'm fearful of losing my dignity. One lady I remember on Kilroy complaining that she wouldn't be able to put on her makeup herself. That was how she defined dignity. I think dignity is about how people treat each other. It's about the respect that we give to other people, not just about how we feel about ourselves.
But why should society make a judgment how somebody feels about their misery or their own loss of dignity?
Because society wants to protect them. Society wants to preserve the well-being of the individual and the well-being of the community, and therefore killing people who are a burden, who are going through a difficult time, as one or two of the panellists have already talked about, is something which society says no way here in the UK.
Anne McElvoy.
There is, of course, another way around this, isn't there? The so-called double effect, in which doctors simply give higher doses of painkillers to those towards the end of life or in extreme suffering. Do you think that that is acceptable and gets you round your worry, Professor, about killing, as you put it?
Well, my father died from an overdose of opium. Somebody said, the doctor killed your father. I say that was not true. The doctor's intention always was to relieve my father's pain. The trouble was drugs are limited, and as the pain increased, so the dosage increased. Eventually there was a double effect, not only the pain relief, but it actually hastened his death. But that was not his intention. If he had another way of doing it, he would have done it.
Fine, but as we well know, you can easily shade there, or the doctor involved has to be sort of confronted with a bit of a calculated moral hypocrisy, because sometimes it is perfectly clear that the giving of the bigger dose is going to lead to the end of life. Do you not worry that you're kind of hiding one moral problem inside another one? Sorry.
It's nothing at all hypocritical about knowing that medicine is limited, that there are certain drugs which have limitations and side effects. But you give it because you're concerned about the well-being of the patient.
But it just means you then don't have to... No, but you were so strong earlier on killing. You really felt we had to call a spade a spade. But in many of these
Absolutely.
Cases... Absolutely. Yes, right. But in many cases, the giving of the drug is intended also to bring about the end of life, or if the intention is not expressed, it is implicit. Is that not a very difficult ethical territory?
Well, I'm amazed that a professor of Islamic studies is able to judge the intention of every individual doctor and to say this is the one clear intention. Now, he or she may well know what the results and effects will be, but that's
but
the
actually,
intention is shown
by
the behaviour
over
a period of time.
But, well, Menzdiki will speak for herself. I was asking you, I find that, and as it happens, I'm in favour of assisted dying, but I find that territory terribly difficult morally, because I'm not really sure on what grounds the decision has been taken.
Which decision are we talking about now? If we're going to help people die, I've been in hospice where people have begged that their loved one be given a fatal injection. Sometimes staff have actually left a syringe and said, use it, and they've come back and the syringe is unused because the family could not cope with the notion, one, that they'd killed their loved one, and two, living with the memory of what they'd done.
What if the loved one really would wish to have had that contents of that syringe injected. Do you? What happens to their will? Where does? What's the moral status of what they wanted when it's a settled will and the pain is intense and they want to leave this life? What is their status in this argument?
Well, their status in the argument is certainly not that any individual in any society is not free to do whatever they want. We restrain the freedom of the individual for the sake of harming themselves or for the sake of harm they do to other people. That's fundamental to any social society. For the individual in pain, what we're talking about is the failure of pain medication and the failure for us to develop the kind of research which brings about effective, total pain relief.
Professor David Cook. David, good to hear your voice again. Thank you very much indeed.
Good to hear you too, Michael. Thank you.
Our last witness is Leslie Close, who appeared on the Moral Maze in 2008 after she'd accompanied her brother John, who had motor neurone disease, to Switzerland for physician-assisted suicide. She was to have been with us here in the studio, but her house flooded, so is on the phone there. Leslie, commiserations on that. A decade on, do you still feel strongly about this?
I feel stronger than I did when we spoke in 2008.
Why?
Because though we have the Lords showing their wholehearted support for the Falconer Bill and then MPs voted against the wishes of their constituents, we've had the world changing, continuing to address the issue, but the UK not addressing it. 50 million Americans now live with assisted dying laws, and we keep the situation, the status quo here. The legal situation's moved on too. The Supreme Court called on Parliament to change the law to solve the problem, and they didn't do it. Scotland has moved on. There's been confirmed that there's no crime of assisted suicide in Scotland, but we still have the status quo.
So you feel the argument is going in your direction, but nobody's taking any notice of it?
Absolutely.
Claire Fox?
I mean, I find it a bit depressing that there's, you know, millions more people now are kind of almost like giving in to this notion that it's inevitable that we should just kind of assist people in dying. It just seems to me to be culturally very pessimistic.
It's not as essential that we assist them. It's essential that they have the choice to ask that if they want it.
I worry about a kind of morals by majority plebiscite in this one, you know, that everyone's on our side. But anyway, on that point about choice, one of the things if I could ask you, nonetheless, if it's a choice, if the individual really wanted to end their life, as one of our earlier witnesses said, they could. They could just starve themselves.
Yes,
it sounds cruel.
That's a particularly unpleasant way to die.
I agree, and it sounds horrible when I say it, but I wanted to know just if choice is the real issue. You know, when your brother or anyone else asks a family member to go with them to take their life, I mean, are they asking your permission, approval there?
Not at all.
So what's the... where's the moral, I suppose, decision lying? Because somebody is killing that person.
No, the person is ending their own life. That's really important. And they're ending their own life at a time when it's coming to an end anyway.
But they're not, are they? That's the whole thing, is that somebody else is implicated. You're asking somebody else to help you to die.
But that's the case at the moment when people are taking decisions to withdraw from treatment or to refuse treatment. Patients tell doctors that they won't take any more action, they won't have any more antibiotics, and doctors have to stand by and agree to that.
The thing I'm worried about is a kind of watering down of moral agency. And in a way, the person who wants to die, implicating the family members, other people like doctors or other family members, and saying, I need you to help me do this.
Can I tell you, Claire, what the doctor said to my brother after he'd spoken to him? John couldn't speak, but he had his organiser to type out messages. And after they'd talked privately for a while, he asked me to go into the room with him. And the doctor asked me about John's prognosis, his diagnosis, whether I understood what was implied in the decision he'd taken. And then he said, as a doctor, my first duty is to preserve life. Here in Switzerland, I have an extra duty and I will perform it for you. I will write the prescription to allow you to end your life. Doctors find a way to make this work. It's not a compulsory thing for doctors to be involved with. There's a conscientious objection clause in all of those American states which now have assisted dying and throughout Europe. But the doctors who are able to make it work for their own moral compass They're wonderful people.
Giles Fraser?
Can I just take a step back for a second and ask you about this business about choice? Do you ever worry about the big choices you have to make in your life? You know, buying a car, moving house, all that sort of stuff?
Well, of course.
You do. And presumably, the more important the decision, the more worry you'd have.
Yes, indeed.
So, and also, I imagine that if you get elderly or ill or you're frail, then often that sort of worrying doubles up.
Yep.
So my anxiety is that you're asking someone, you said you're giving them a choice as if it makes them free, but that choice can often be incredibly burdensome to people, just like the worry that you have, that you just admitted, of making a big decision. You're asking people in this time of life to make this enormously big decision.
I'm asking for people to have the right to discuss this possibility with their medical practitioners. I'm asking for them to be assessed for their mental competence and for the pressure that other people might be perceived as putting upon them.
But what about the pressure? Just the question itself. Mm-hmm. You know, should I do it? Should I not? I don't think there's lots of bad relatives out there pushing people, but that question is itself burdensome.
I don't believe so, because I think I saw how difficult it was for John to go through this process, and I think unless you really are completely dedicated to the idea, you will fall at the first hurdle. I really do.
So it is difficult to make that decision.
It was difficult for John, yes.
Right. I mean, that's why I think this is an incredibly difficult thing to ask people. I think it's burdensome to, as it were, transfer the responsibility for your, especially when you're crying out, I just want to be bloody cared for, and now you're being asked to be make another big choice.
Who are you transferring the responsibility to?
To the person who's ill.
Well, I'm glad that they've got the responsibility for it.
When you're ill, often you just want someone to care for you. You don't want to have more and more choices.
No, but I think, judging by the experience I saw of my brother, when he realised that he had the choice of going to Switzerland, it was as though a weight had been lifted from his shoulders and a light went back on in his eyes, a light that had been dying and fading, because he realised that he could take control at the end of his life, and that to him, what was really important to him.
Leslie Close, thank you very much indeed, and good luck with your flood, by the way.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Thanks. Well, some interesting witnesses reappearing on the programme. Our first witness came up with a kind of rather nuanced position. This is Dr. Yule. The doctor should quietly speed up death in certain cases, but not change the law. Leave it to the discretion of the doctor. A lot of people argue that, don't they? What do you think, Giles?
Well, I can also see this bit where you say, look, I think it's wrong, but I do it. I can understand that. I mean, I think it's wrong, but I'd help my mother. It's just like you do these things for family members in pain, and I just accept the fact that it's wrong, but I still think it's wrong.
Yeah. But I think he put his finger on the contradiction that Giles cited when he opened up by saying, I think it's wrong, I'd do it for my mother. But if you do it for your mother, you should rethink whether you think it's wrong.
I do think it's wrong. I'd still do it, though. Isn't that part of caring for someone?
I think that is a sort of incuriosity in that position. And I have a bit of a worry more broadly that when... What he wanted, in a way, is that evasion. Everyone, we all want a bit of evasion in this. It's nicer not to be on the hook on it. But he wanted to say, once you put it into law, some bad things will happen, which won't happen if you don't put it into law. And I think really what that does is it allows, if you like, for kind of secretive channels in which we don't really know what's happening. We're not able to subject it to public debate and scrutiny. So I felt more uncomfortable about that. I think that if you believe in it, you should also believe that it should at least be part of a debate. About whether it should go to law.
He didn't believe in it, because I think that's where the conundrum was for me, that he wasn't against assisted dying. He wasn't against that principle. He just didn't want it legalised.
He didn't want it legalised.
I think he was against it. Yes. Well, I thought he was against it.
He did talk about execution and compared it to capital punishment, so I don't think he took
because he did dance around it a little, because he did actually say, as a principle, as his principle, that we should not, as a society, participate in the killing of people, really.
And I also think that one of the things that was kind of implicit in what he was saying, and also came up in afterwards, actually, I think with our second witness, was this sort of thing about what is the decision? Why do we why do we allow, apparently, as a society? And the first witness talked about the European conference and, you know, broadening categories of people who now would say that they're going through psychological suffering. The thing I think is that what the argument about legalising does, apart from anything else, is that we've got to consider the social consequences and the cultural shift that would occur if we basically say that the state can say yes to removing somebody's life because of the quality of their life, because they say they're hurting or in pain. I mean, and I'm not trying to doubt in any way, but lots of people who actually go for this actually are not suffering physical pain. I then get very nervous when it's psychological pain. And actually, but then we end up in a... That is a bit slippery slope.
But Claire, isn't all medical treatment a moral issue? Why are we treating this
because
differently?
I have to say that in that sense, I do think life is rather better than death. And for me, medical intervention is about ensuring that life continues.
But also...
So I actually think a very serious proper principle, if you want, is medicine has got no right to take life. Yeah.
But
as
actually, medicine could make it a good death. If we see death... But if we see both life and death as natural existences, then why are we so averse to what happens at the end of life when we try and do everything at the beginning of life with medical intervention?
Actually, it's not that people want a good death. They just don't want to know about death. They don't want to die. Actually, people want to get out of death without actually dying. That's the thing. And because they don't see
death. What
was
Woody Allen's great line about that? Not worried about dying, just ever want
to
be
there when it happens. Yeah.
Doesn't that prove that most people, even if this was legalised, most people don't want to die? So there won't be a mad rush of everybody saying, look, I want my life to be ended.
Can I just move this on a bit? One of the points that one of the first two witnesses said was that because we're talking about assisted dying here, that suicide is A, not illegal, and B, is an option for everybody. Everybody, if they wanted to, could actually commit suicide on their own.
The only problem everything speaks for that argument except the facts, that most people who find themselves in a position towards of extreme frailty, pain, often immobility. We had the example from the last witness of the brother dying of motor neuron disease, a particularly vicious condition. To then say, you know what, why are you involving anyone else? All you have to do is, you know, go on the internet, do whatever, and find a way to kill yourself. I have to think that is a callous argument. I think it is evasive. I think it's unpleasant because you're saying to a lot of people, sort out something for yourself when they're begging to be helped, and it is not the answer to the question before us tonight.
Claire. I actually think that's the interesting thing is that, you know, the callousness sounds as though if you say you have to do this decision yourself and not involve other people. But when you say people are begging to be helped, what I'd say is when they're begging to be helped to remove from life, that we as the loved ones and as society will say, no, your life is so valuable to us that we don't want you to go, right? We don't want you to go. We will do everything and anything
Their will doesn't factor for you.
You're saying is that you're saying, because people are actually saying, my will is to give up my will, and you're saying, I'm going to struggle with you, rather than saying, you want it, give it to you, right?
But she talks about moral agency. But why shouldn't that person have a moral agency?
I'm suggesting that you
love me, but this is my decision.
I'm suggesting that you're undermining the moral agency of that individual by not fighting for their life, for their agency to continue. Otherwise, you snuff out their agency.
If I say to my kids, I want to die now, and they go, yeah, all right, Dad, I'd be enormously cheesed off. I want them to fight against what I just said.
I mean
in those situations.
Can I just move on to Dr. Owen? There are two things about him that I thought were rather interesting. Was this question about what is suffering unbearably, and particularly whether it applies to psychological conditions as well as physical ones. And the second I thought was interesting was where the doctors are in all this. He said the main function of a doctor is to help the patient, by implication, not necessarily or totally to preserve life. Anne.
He tests my position, particularly on the unbearable suffering clause, which is why, like you said when you asked at the beginning, Michael, I don't support voluntary euthanasia, because I think it's too difficult a category. And people may say fairly, my mental suffering is so great, why is it you're, according to me, you know, people who believe what I believe, I have to wait till I'm terminally ill and nearly dead before you would help me. But I think there are good reasons, and I think he was pointing to them and Claire was probing away at them, which is really, it is quite hard to say what is unbearable. it's quite hard to say that something that I find unbearable today I might find unpleasant and a trial, but bearable tomorrow, and would be pleased that Giles had come and told me to carry on living, yeah, whether I wanted to or not. So I do think there is a difficult category there, and I feel I myself have not crossed that line into euthanasia, although, of course, as we've seen, a number of European countries have.
Clem?
I think that I just wanted to emphasise that on the agency question here, that's the thing is that in some of these European countries, there are people presenting themselves saying, not that they're physically unable to die, but they're actually saying, I don't want to commit suicide. That's a horrible, grotesque, don't be so inhumane. My will and my agency is asking you to help me humanely. And there are doctors who sit around and consider this. And that is barbaric. That is where society loses its sense of fighting for people's humanity. Now, when you say, well, if their will is to die and you're denying it, no, I'm not, because they can take their own life. That's true. But whether society can endorse that is a whole different ballgame.
What do we think about David Cook's point, strongly made in relation to his own father and opiates that eventually reached such a level that they had the effect of killing him? Now, is this... is this a useful moral elision, or is it moral weaseling, Giles?
Well, it obviously can be used as an alibi under which to do all sorts of things. It's very easy to use the double...
A lot of people would say this is common sense, a doctor's acting out of...
But I do think it's common sense. I agree with you. So, yeah. I mean, so even though it can be used as an alibi, I think that actually the idea that you treat the suffering, and if, as a consequence of that, you die, then...
It's a double thing.
It's a double thing. That
seems to be the difficulty. That if, let's say, the person themselves asks for the dose to be raised, they are basically asking you to assist the dying, and you have deniability. Yeah. Might be medically convenient. It might be an okay way to go about things for a while, but it doesn't morally clarify the situation. Yeah. And I think it can turn into humbug.
And he wanted to make the distinction between assisted dying and killing, and was very strong on that. Let's call it what it is. But I think for me, the issue with him was that I don't really think he satisfied anything around human dignity and sanctity of life beyond his own religious perspective.
And what did the rest of us make of Giles' rather powerful and interesting argument that giving people in these terminal stages, very difficult terminal stages of life, choice was a burden for them? I mean, that's the anti-autonomy argument, isn't it? I won't ask you, Claire, because you agree with him. Or maybe you don't.
I very strongly disagree. And I think, again, it's a bit of how can we possibly know? There are some people who don't like to be confronted with a lot of choices. But most people would like some say in how their lives end.
Giles, very briefly.
Well, look, this idea here is just there's an autonomous, strong moral agent, and people who are dying are not autonomous, strong moral agents. They're extremely vulnerable and they should be treated as such.
OK, panel, that's it from this week. For this week, rather. From our panel, Anne McElvoy, Claire Fox, Mona Siddiqui and Giles Fraser, and from me, until the same time next week, goodbye.